Welcome, I'm Moshe Ferber.
And I am Ariel Munafon.
And this is the Silver Lining Podcast, a podcast about security architecture.
And with you today, Ariel Munafon, also Moshe Ferber. Hello, Moshe.
Hey, good morning. And we got with us Demi Ben-Ari, which is the VP R&D for Panorize. Panorize is a software as a service company that is basically doing a third-party assessment. We know that supply chain attacks are getting more popular. So Panorize are basically trying to eliminate this attack vector. Demi, introduce yourself. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you guys for having me. I would like to also introduce the company a bit and myself also. So as Moshe had mentioned, my name is Demi Ben-Ari. I'm one of the co-founders of Panorize. And we basically help companies to manage the cybersecurity risk that is imposed by their suppliers. In origin, in the past, I was in the Israeli Air Force. There, I actually developed a missile defense system. And I was a software engineer, a team leader, and then a senior engineer. And afterwards, I started working in a company called Windward. Basically, what I did with missiles in the Israeli Air Force, I did with the ships when I left the military. There, I started handling more the context of instead of on-prem near real-time systems, cloud infrastructure. We migrated the whole platform from an on-prem deployment to AWS and working with the big data technologies. And I'm also one of the organizers and co-founders of several developer communities focused in big data, data science, and cloud. And in the company, basically what we do is we help companies to also comply to regulations and compliance issues. Like Moshe had mentioned, the whole world of third-party security is really hot today. And more than 60% of hacks are being done through weaker links in the chain and smaller companies that our customers work with. And they go to the smaller companies, hack them, and steal all of the information of the larger corporations and companies.
Amazing. Yeah. And well, actually, what Panorize is doing is really interesting because, third party is one of the biggest weaknesses, and it's very hard to monitor them, and it's very hard to decide, okay, how can I choose my partners wisely? But actually, we're not here to talk about this one. We're here to talk about security engineering. And
yes,
you have a very interesting story. I mean, you're a new company. It's still haven't written line of code, and you know that you're going to be software as a service, and you're a security company, which means that you have to be really secured. I mean, you have to let your customers know that the data is in a reliable place, that they can trust you. So right now you have this knowledge that you're going to be a software as a service, that you're going to be a security company, and now you have to start planning your infrastructure, start planning your deployment. Tell us about the topic of this discussion is about using Kubernetes, but I guess you had so many decisions to make before you reached to this point. So really interested in, okay, so we decided to start a company. We understand what we are going to do. How do we choose the platform? What is the path that you've been through?
Also the path, and also the question I want to know that you asked yourself. This is very important, at least for me.
Okay, great. And as you mentioned, the whole impact here is that we come from our expertise and knowledge from the world of security, and also we have experience in on-prem and cloud. So eventually you need to end up with some kind of decision when you go to start building a company, when you're three people in the garage and you want to scale and move through to new customers, and you need to move fast. And starting to work on a physical data center somewhere, it will take a lot of time and a lot of effort in matter of DevOps and specifically operations and literally buying a new server. It sounds so illogical. And what we wanted to do is move fast. So the first question that you need to ask, what's the expertise of the team that currently is in place? And what we had is expertise, first of all, from the cloud, from what I bring, and also from the world of security. Cybersecurity in general, and we had security researchers. So eventually you end up with people which are first of all, know some infrastructure and automation and the whole world of, and context of cloud. So this is important to go. Basically, you need to choose a cloud service provider because I don't want to manage servers. But you also need to kind of incorporate the abilities of security researchers that know really well how to hack things probably, but don't know much about scale and how is it to like system engineering in general, and how is it to build a large scale operations and systems. So eventually these are the questions that we'd ask. So we had people that know cloud and people that know security. So it's really straightforward to go with the cloud with a scalable infrastructure that basically I pay as I go and I don't need to put in front a lot of effort and even funds, which we didn't have much in the beginning, to create a scalable infrastructure.
Did you question yourself? I mean, how your customers would react? Can you sell this cloud service to, I don't know, to a large bank with all the regulation? Have you considered?
Yeah. So one of the considerations was basically whose data, the data that I'm collecting, in the manner of like who owns the data? This is the largest question. And basically our scanning and all of the data collection is Panray's proprietary data because I'm collecting data about the world. The only information of customers is basically what I keep in the manner of metadata. So in that context, I'm not like going over logs of companies, which is like sensitive information of a company, and I don't need to put it on-prem. For example, a large bank or a large corporate that a lot of times don't want to release anything from their own network. Put aside my own belief to like if it's secure in the cloud or not, because I really do believe that cloud service providers today arrive to a specific certain point of time in which they're much more secure than other physical data centers, that we actually scan all of these things from the outer perimeter and you can see a lot of like gaps, I would say, in a nice manner.
This is an interesting insight. It took years for people to gain this insight. Mm-hmm. I've been fighting about this insight since 2010.
And still there are people that...
I agree.
Well, it's because there's kivets. There are things that you need to think about in this with this sentence because there's still... We still have cloud hacks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, of course.
And we still have government access to data. So usually when people ask me if cloud is more secure or not, I would ask them, how do you define more secure? If the data is unreachable from hackers, but it's accessible to United States government, is it more secure or less secure? Mm-hmm. It's not the right term to use, more secure or less secure. It's a question of attack vectors. And most of the cloud providers have eliminated many attack vectors. Most of the attack vectors who remain, they're in the customer responsibility.
Of course, which is misconfiguration, one of the biggest pain points, basically.
Yeah, and this was the topic of our previous discussion, so the words are still somewhere in the room. You ended up on the cloud, and you ended up at Google Computer Platform?
Yeah, Google Cloud Platform. I would say a few words. Today, the biggest vendors of cloud service providers actually arrived to a certain point of maturity in which the Me Too effect probably occurs in all, I would say, three of them, the three big ones, okay? Because feature-wise, they probably arrived to a certain point in which they are at a same level, okay? I would say that with caution, but yeah. And eventually you want to end up with somebody that is comfortable for you to work with. And my game changer basically was the people, because the security engineers and the people that work here at Google near the R&D center were really cooperative. I worked with AWS in the past. For me, it was pretty seamless. I'm not afraid of technology. People are more scary, I think, than technology. And basically the cooperativeness of people at GCP, what made me actually go there. And I'm not regretting it 3 years after.
Yeah, this is worth mentioning that Demi is touring around the world and talking about his GCP experience and is helping a lot of people in understanding the challenges and the advantages of this platform. So Google made, I think, a great deal from their point of view. Yeah. They got a really goodwill ambassador working for them. So, so you decided on GCP. Can you tell us a little bit later about how you decided how to build the platform? And in the end, we'll get to Kubernetes, but of course. I guess you had so many decisions before that to make.
Yeah. So eventually you want to move fast. Even before you have a product that you sell, you need to kind of create some kind of cooperation with design partners, people to build the platform with. And eventually when you end up with that, you need to move fast. Okay. So first of all, what kind of technology to choose in the matter of coding language. I think more than 80% of tools today in the world of cybersecurity are written in Python. and specifically security engineers and security people know Python. So it was really straightforward to go as a go-to-market, the first go-to-market to Python and all use and leverage all of the tools. So we ended up with a deployment of a lot of scripts, a lot of things that do data collection in Python, and we deployed everything on virtual machines because it's easy. You just take the code, create, of course, all of the infrastructure in the matter of databases, and you have a lot of hosted service providers also in GCP to create some kind of data storage layer. And it was really straightforward to launch a virtual machine when I want to scan a company. Sounds really logical. And when I want to scale, I just launch more virtual machines. Specifically on Google, it's pretty seamless. Machines can launch in a matter of seconds, even in a matter of like really low amount of seconds. And it's easy. But the thing is that you get to a point in which you underutilize the infrastructure. Why? Because you're talking about scanners, right? You're talking about data collection, you're talking about I/O. And because of that I/O specifically, I am maybe using a lot of the network, but the CPU is pretty idle most of the time, and I'm wasting a lot of money. So in the initial phase, it's awesome, right? When you have like five developers and not too many integration between them to deploy things quickly. I just deploy a new virtual machine image. It's really easy to launch that. I do the scanner and everything. I can launch a larger machine if I need more capacity, and that's it. But I am paying a lot of money. So in the initial phase, when you start the POC, everything is cool. You don't get to network congestion. You don't get to like scale problems because you're trying to validate the idea, right? But what happens when you need to scan thousands of companies or tens of thousands, hundreds? Then you get to a problem. And eventually you need something that will do the whole orchestration and monitoring. And these are all of the challenges that we faced. And of course, you grow your company, right? You have your first paying customer, your second, your third. You need customer success. You eventually end up with growing the whole like operations of the company, and you get blind. Okay, and you don't have any transparency about what's happening in your own infrastructure because we've written all of the orchestration framework in the beginning in cron and bash.
Amazing. Okay. So, by the way, this process of maturing and deciding, we're talking about what, the first few months?
Mm-hmm. Is what? Okay. Yeah, it started, I think, in the first half year, I would say, when we also grew the company in a matter of people and with the engagement with other third parties that we're scanning. So in the beginning, you start off with one, okay? You know, like it's easy and you can even run things manually. Then you build some kind of orchestration framework that does that automatically, but not in a large scale. But right after, I would say, the barrier of 3-4 developers, it became harder. It became harder to manage that. When you get to hundreds of companies that you're scanning, it gets much harder to get transparency about what's like going wrong even, okay? You're assuming that everything is okay, but literally nothing is okay because a lot of things are blowing up in the background and you even don't know about it.
Okay, so you decided to go to GCP, mm-hmm. then you went through the process of, okay, let's try virtual machines, let's try other platforms, and you ended up with decisions to make containers, and mm-hmm. probably when you decide to manage containers, then you decide about Kubernetes.
Yeah.
I mean, what at this point, what kind of changes do you need to make for your team? What kind of changes mm-hmm. do you need to make to your process? What kind of changes do you need to make in the technology area? We always try to look at these things, at the people, process, and technology. Mm-hmm. So can you give us some examples on?
Yep. So first of all, the decision of going to containers. Why? It was mostly for like, I would say for two main reasons. One main reason is utilization of infrastructure. Because I'm a lot I/O bound and I don't need much CPU. And if I need that, I want the infrastructure to provide that in a scalable manner without me asking. So it makes sense to do that. And the other is growing the ability to develop code easily. Because as I said, I have on the one side engineers and the other side security engineers, which is a different kind of beast. And eventually you want to end up with growing both abilities of adding more engineers and adding more security people without the need of changing code and a lot of code. You will need to change code eventually. And of course, you end up with who's orchestrating everything and who's automating that because somebody needs to do that. So you have the first of all, need to develop code easily. You need some kind of CI/CD pipeline, continuous integration, continuous, I would say, delivery and not deployment. Really small amount of percentage of companies in the world arrive to continuous deployment. And then you need to grow your people more, and because you need to support more customers, more features, etc. So eventually you end up with, I need to grow my whole infrastructure as a company, and I need to add more functionality to the skill set of people. Because then I did all of the automation in the engineering team, but wait, do I need a DevOps guy right now? Yes, the answer is yes. I need somebody that this is his expertise and knows how to connect between the engineering side, the I want to write clean code, with, wait, where am I running all of that infrastructure, and how can I scale that with the click of a button without changing a lot of code? So you need to add more abilities to your own like team in place to also support all of the infrastructure that you want to introduce to your company.
Before we go to more in the PPT, if you started now the company, mm-hmm. would you still made the 3 or 4 or 6 months on VMs or not?
It really depends with what kind of expertise the people that we initiate the company come with. Because if I had the focus with a large engineering team in the beginning and I have a lot of funds, then probably I would go to build some kind of easy infrastructure, because Kubernetes today is easy. Okay, it's I would take the chance and say it's commodity today, and I would start off with building some kind of ability of CI/CD pipeline with Kubernetes, and then start throwing code at it. Mm-hmm. Okay, but then it made more sense because of the maturity of all of the tools in the cloud infrastructure and everything, and because this was the team that I had in place. Yeah. So it made sense at that specific point in time to make that decision.
Yeah, the idea is that in this 2 years that that pass, mm-hmm. things change, and you need to
adapt to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back a second. Yeah. Continuous delivery versus continuous deployment. Where do you see the difference? I mean,
okay. So eventually, all of the people like to take CI/CD as continuous integration, continuous delivery. Continuous deployment, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a lie, because continuous deployment means that users are immediately getting all of the new features without me being able to control that. Once some developer actually deploys code to Git, it goes through some kind of pipeline and workflow, and eventually ends up with users.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to that means that you need to be in such a high testing coverage and also with assurance with your whole infrastructure that a company in the early stages probably won't get to that. And if it gets to that, probably it's wasting their own, I won't say, infrastructure as a company to focus on things that are not important, because you need to iterate fast. You need to throw code fast. And if you invest a lot of effort into infrastructure in the matter of CI/CD and testing, etc., a lot of times you will fail and not fast enough.
Okay, so what you're saying basically is that continuous deployment means that the developer finished deploying, the code gets immediately to the user, which is
immediately after a testing period of something. So, yes,
which is very hard to do. So most company will settle with a company develop the code, submit it. It goes to the integration, it integrates to the code, then it gets up to somewhere to the production environment, not for all the users. This is where you start your graduated deployment.
Mm-hmm. I would say even a more cautious manner of deploying automatically to staging, mm-hmm. somebody doing some kind of QA or assurance even before it gets released to the customers. And I would add another step to that of feature flagging. Because even when you deploy to production, then eventually you don't have to introduce the feature to all of your customers. So I can feature flag that to an alpha tester or beta tester to kind of test it out and maybe even go back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I see what you're getting to. Okay, so now you have a company, you have basically what we learn on your software as a service, you're using security mm-hmm. services. Now you have two, basically you need to service two kinds of population. You have your security researchers, mm-hmm. which need to deploy their own code. They're not very good at it, but they're writing code.
Mm-hmm.
So it might not be the cleanest one, it might not be scalable, but you need to run it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And you have your own developers, and you that needs to have the solid common ground engineering. You call them mm-hmm. the engineering. And how, so tell us, how did you change your process? And later on, we'll talk about how, what kind of people do you need and what kind of technology back infrastructure do you need.
Okay, awesome. So eventually, we'll start in the beginning. We had one team that developed the whole infrastructure, meaning also writing the code of the collectors, also writing the web servers that are our customers access, and even all of the monitoring infrastructure that we have to kind of like have transparency of, about what's happening.
And probably they clean the floors at the end of the day. And
yeah, and the shopping to the office and everything, of course, yes. So,
and it was me, Demi.
Yeah, but don't tell them, you're just ruining that. And eventually you need to kind of do some kind of separation of concerns. Because the expertise of the engineering team is to build scalable infrastructure, to support a lot of users, to kind of create even the ops around it, to kind of have some transparency about the production environment. The expertise of the security researchers, which are really talented people, is basically creating the abilities to collect the information, right? And to create some kind of transparency about the our like third parties that we're scanning, but they don't know scale. Okay, and it's harder for them to kind of comprehend about what it is to run a large scale system in production. So I kind of want to strengthen all of the strength of each team, and I need to add more skill set to my own team. So we kind of divided the engineering effort or the R&D to two teams. One team is the engineering team, which will create the platform and create all of the abilities for scalability. And the security research team that will still be connected to the production environment and see what customers are seeing because they're in the whole workflow, but they are developing abilities. Okay, and it's easy for them to develop abilities. I don't want to, most cybersecurity companies, I would say, even not startups, even the large companies, what they do is they have the security research team, which are the, I would say, the bad boys, okay, developing abilities really fast and doing something that will kind of penetrate a lot of companies. But eventually, when you end up that you want to take that ability and put that in production, they kind of pass it on to the engineering team for 2 or 3 months of development.
Yeah, because developing at scale and developing nice is boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
They like it clean and dirty.
That? Yeah, but eventually it kind of gives you a blocker of even introducing new features takes months instead of like immediately I need some kind of ability and I want to put it in. And as you know, things in the world of cybersecurity are overchanging always. And the thing is that new things are being introduced, and what happens if you have a new breach? How like your time to market is really, really important. Mm-hmm. So I know that every ability that is developed by the security research team and goes to production might even take 150% of the time, maybe even 200% of the time. But it keeps the security researchers engaged with what the customers are seeing, and my time to market gets shortened really vastly. Mm-hmm. So I'd really rather take that risk.
Okay. So those are the changes you made to your to your developing process and the way that you build your services. What kind of people do you need? I mean, any changes in the market for that?
Okay, so first, you know, the cool word of DevOps, okay? And a lot of people actually take that and develop that to DevSecOps. And a lot of people like to call that SREs, software reliability engineers, and production engineers, and super duper ops wizard, or whatever they want to call that. So eventually you need somebody that knows automation, that knows to kind of create a connection between the world of engineering and infrastructure and ops. And this is basically DevOps, okay? Other people might dispute the name DevOps and what it actually means, but it doesn't really matter. And you end up with a person that today needs to know code, okay? It's not only like being the cool kid that knows Bash and Cron, and that's it, I know Linux, and I'm a cool IT administrator. For example, even if you're using Jenkins today, you need to learn Groovy to kind of like create some kind of automation scripts, and you need to know Python to parse things and create ETL jobs, maybe to create some kind of monitoring platform to your infrastructure. So it's not a surprise, we needed a DevOps guy. And this was kind of the integration between the two teams, and our DevOps engineer actually goes to all of our sprint plannings. And we go on the retro and kind of understand what are the problems that both teams have in the matter of communication. And he's the one that closes all of these gaps. and kind of like releases all of the bottlenecks, which is really important for from our view of actually developing software.
Okay, so this goes through all of our podcasts that ops guys need to know scripting. What they really need to know is changing, but definitely scripting.
It's not just ops, it's everyone.
Everybody.
It's the same, I would say, that engineers today need to know cloud. Okay, they need to know where my code is running and need to be connected to that, and not I'm like taking the code, my code is clean, everything is good, and I will throw it to the ops guy that will handle that in production. It's not my worries.
Okay. Going down one level, I mean, what kind of specific knowledge are you looking for? I mean, in the previous conversation, we talked about Git knowledge. We talked about, you mentioned Groovy and Python. Anything else you're looking at specific skill sets?
So it will be, as you mentioned, Git is important because all of the developers are working in that. And even when you're going in the manner of DevOps itself as infrastructure as code, okay, that all of the configuration of your physical infrastructure is also kept on Git. And you want to reproduce that easily with a click of a button. So the DevOps guy actually needs to know Git and needs to know how all of the configuration is kept, right? And how you launch things and automation of all of that, using tools like even like Ansible, Puppet, Chef to orchestrate everything in the matter of infrastructure even before something is running in your production system. So this is important. Going another step further, you need to understand the development process, right? Git is awesome, but Git is super complicated. And if you don't understand how the team is working, saying agile is not specific enough. How you're working with branches, okay? How you're deploying to which kind of environments, then you need to understand how developers are working. And then adapt all of the infrastructure to the workflow, because every company does that differently. There is no cookie cutter for that.
Okay, so they need basically our new DevOps guys need to know a little bit development, some kind of scripting language, Python, Groovy, whatever.
Even JavaScript. Even why? JavaScript. Because a lot of services are written in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. You need to know NPM, how deployment is made, package management. You need to know Docker. This is like a 101 today, and how you keep your Docker containers and everything, and even like release management. Versions, what do you do with versions, right?
Okay, so they really need to understand well the configuration management and also the software framework. Okay, and the last thing, technology changes you've witnessed, how this has affected you?
There are a few. Okay, in the beginning, we had virtual machines, lots of virtual machines, okay? And we wanted to save a lot of money there, but also the effort and get some kind of transparency. So what we did in the beginning is we had written our own orchestration infrastructure. I don't want to do that. There is somebody that did that better than me. Our brother, I would say, Kubernetes. And basically having that as a go-to-market tool, and specifically if you're working on GCP, it was like fully integrated from day one with everything, and it's pretty easy. And today, all of the other cloud service providers are catching up to that and creating a managed service of Kubernetes. This is really important, okay? And because of that, it was really straightforward for somebody that has an orchestration framework for Docker containers. We've transformed everything to Docker containers because everything is confined. Right now, I don't need to at least like be worried that all of my packages are written in Python and started working with virtual envs and all of the crossing between different versions of Python and everything. Everything is encapsulated in a Docker container. Somebody is handling the orchestration of all of that. It's really easy to plug and play monitoring tools to that. It's seamless to kind of like understand that you need to go to Kubernetes.
Okay, interesting. We talked previously. We talked to Riskified CIO, and he told us about all the tools that he needed in order to integrate Kubernetes into a Google computer, into AWS, like the ISTO for networking and the IAM roles permission. I understand this is in JCP. This is much easier.
Yeah, it was really seamless to actually integrate everything. So, for example, they've introduced also features of taking the IAM roles in Google and having everything as service accounts. So even my services are accessing only the relevant data that you need to access, which is really important for me as a sec guy. Okay, I'm on my other hat of getting something that is secure. Okay, and even when I have a closed VPC on Google Cloud with all of the firewalls in place and everything, even if you have somebody inside the network, you can't be able to access you shouldn't be able to access actually like other pieces of the infrastructure that you're not authorized to. So this is seamless, basically using Google Cloud. Of course, on top of it, we needed to add some kind of application framework, role-based access control to that. But this is for our own users and not backend services.
This is not for the developers. This is for your consumers.
And of course, you know, like SSO and MFA, the basic things, I would say, that prevent 95% of all of the security issues coming from the outside.
Yeah, actually, I see that organizations are requiring today SSO just for even for operational usage. I mean, not from security reasons, because they want to make sure that the users will have a clear experience. Yeah, Federation, I think it's a for software as a service company that is doing enterprise selling, this is a must today. I see many people encounter challenges with Kubernetes regarding monitoring and logging and basically understand what is going on behind the scenes. How do you deal with that?
So that integration was pretty easy also on GCP. So they have a product that is called Stackdriver that today is kind of like transformed to GCP monitoring. Okay, this is the title. And the integration of logging and basic, I would say, physical infrastructure of all of the CPU usage, memory, etc. With a click of a button, you basically get that on Stackdriver. So that was pretty easy from day one, like zero to hero. But once you need to kind of correlate all of the application metrics and user metrics to that, it becomes pretty tricky, okay? So if we mentioned about what are the skill set of the DevOps engineer that needs to be introduced, in the past, kind of like data engineers would do that, but today DevOps people also need to do ETL jobs. And because of that, you need some kind of scripting language, as we said, Python or something. So we can created an infrastructure with even a relational database that we ETL all of the information and correlated information about infrastructure, user experience, and user usage in a single dashboard in Grafana, which sits on top of a relational database. And we query that to kind of create transparency all of our infrastructure and correlation between user metrics and operational metrics with the infrastructure, okay? And when I'm capping in the manner of CPU, I know to correlate that because I have a really high usage of scanners right now.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Before we go to summarize, I want to ask you a question, a personal question, Demi. How do you manage to study so much? Because because I think that this is like we went to our podcast that talk about technology and all the changes that are going down in the world. I just stopped learning.
I get what you're saying. First of all, I don't believe that I study enough. I think I'm not getting to like 95% of the things that I want to learn. But the community engagement and all of the talks with people and kind of understanding the other companies and how they're working and how they're doing things is really important to get an ingest, because even with that, I'm disqualifying a lot of things that might not work for my own use case. So by learning that, I'm saving myself time. Once I know what to use, I can go into depth in the T model, I would say. I know a really broad variety of technologies and things that people are doing, but when I need to go more into depth, I just dive in specifically to solve some kind of problem. And the community engagement and the things that I'm doing out of the company is something that kind of like widens the variety of input that I have to things, even if it's the world of security and going to conferences and talking. Because like for me, the experience of going to a conference and talking to developers or security people is to have some kind of stage to people to say that I'm stupid, that I did something wrong, because this is the only stage that somebody will actually like dispute me. Even if I'm writing a blog post, the chances of somebody writing comment that I will like benefit from are slim, near to zero.
Yeah. And this is something that I think that we need to encourage, is to really talk, to share information, and to not be, you know, scared of also giving comments and getting back.
I think these podcasts and all of the engagement that we have with people in technology like Ariel and Moshe are like super important in my opinion. And even getting some kind of feedback, even like we brought Moshe to our company to give us feedback about the workflow that we're doing. As somebody that sees a lot of companies, and getting that feedback is super valuable for like the company, the technology, and even the go-to-market with customers.
Okay.
So summarizing, we're running out of time. So Panorize had a challenge. They needed to build software as a service. It was a security company, so they couldn't escape with any security requirement. They needed to fill them all. So you started up working with instances, and you soon realized that it's not efficient. It's not covering your need, and you need to be first more. You need to work faster. You need to have more efficient deployments. You need to work more efficiently on the cost point of view. I mean, not to deploy things you don't need. So this is where you moved into containers and Kubernetes, which gave you this, which give you the flexibility. It also enables you to, because you have a diverse development team, security researchers and developers, it gives you the ability to take a code that a security researcher is doing and running it in a pretty closed garden where it can be, it can work up independently without messing with other environment. Regarding the challenges, so you had to change your the way that the company is built, the deployment process. You built two different core systems, two different core teams, the engineering teams and the security researcher teams that are working together. From the people point of view, you need developers. Even if it's DevOps guys, they need to know the basics of development. They need to understand scripting. They need to understand Git, right? They need to understand the development environment. And of course, from the technology point of view, you had to, because you're working batch and this is not your real use case for Kubernetes, you have to develop your own workflow
manager.
Workflow manager, and you have to, but the good thing is that because Kubernetes is integrated well into GCP, you didn't have to do some kind of mapping of permissions and building different services like IAM roles to Kubernetes roles. So it was easier for you guys from this point of view. Regarding logging and monitoring, currently you need to take it to somewhere that you can store it safely and basically build your own graph on top of it using one of the known BI application. This is what you made. Anything you want to add on top of it?
We didn't go into depth more of the implementation of the workflow manager because I think it's a really different subject than what we came to talk about. But we've built the transporter, which is the workflow manager, as you said, and a lot of people disputed that and said, why aren't you using like really common tools in the market today like Airflow or Luigi? 2.5 years ago, it wasn't that mature enough, okay? And it didn't answer our specific use case. But the cool thing that we had achieved is basically with a click of a button, when we needed to add 2 times as much capacity of customers, what we did is basically launched more servers on our Kubernetes cluster, enhanced the throughput of the workflow manager itself, and kind of like ramped up the database server just a bit more to handle more throughput. And that's it. This is the only thing that we need to do. And to introduce new features and to introduce new scanners and new hacks that come out, we kind of like respond to that super quickly. The security researchers need to add more abilities. That's it. We scale more abilities without changing the whole like infrastructure of running all of the orchestration on the cloud. So this is a pretty amazing point. We are not perfect. I'm not saying that, but we're over improving always. And because of that, it's easy for us to introduce new changes because of the whole of the technology infrastructure. So I'm really proud of people.
One of the biggest pain points I see in companies is that usually at a certain point, they need to re-engineer. I mean, talking about startups, they really need to, they need to, okay, we're pausing everything, we're stopping developing in the future, we need to re-engineer stuff in order to manage the new scale. So you're saying that currently, at least, you managed to bypass this.
Hopefully, yeah.
this stage. Until and you get stuck.
you will get stuck eventually, okay? Yeah. You will get to some kind of like glass ceiling, but eventually, for us, it's really easy to scale our customer base according to the amount of servers and money that I'm spending on infrastructure.
Also, you're not real time, right? Your scanner can run, you don't care if it's running at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock. It's not...
It is running always. I'm aggregating things in the SLA that I want to give to our customers. There are customers that want that in a matter of hours, which is, I don't know, pretty uncommon use case. Usually daily basis is good enough for most of them because right now they have coverage that is annual. In the good case, they have annual, okay? So going into granularity level of daily is amazing for most customers.
Okay, Ariel, you want to close with something?
I would just say that it was really interesting and I follow you, so keep doing that and keep giving back to the community is very important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Demi.
Thank you to all our listeners, and until the next one.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.